see, of this new book. The book will be coming out in October, right?
Yes.
Called How to Beauty Inner Joy, Contemplating the Soul of the Renaissance. Forward by Thomas More. And I'll read you a nice blurb that Jocelyn Godfrey said about the book. Jocelyn, who was with us in Florence when we did have the conference that Julianne came to, which I think I mentioned on Friday night, was an amazingly golden experience, a very beautiful conference. Certainly, when we did our hermetic dinner and the chef carved a door, he carved a hermetic door just for the dinner with a moon on one side and the sun on the other. And that's my kind of chef, he was. And we did all the courses of the dinner within a hermetic and Kabbalistic way, and we had the correspondences, the scents, the flowers, the colors, etc., all for each of the meals. Anyway, it was a very special occasion, and it lives in my memory, and the memory of many of us who were there in a very happy way. So Julianne was there, and it helped inspire her work on the Renaissance, which has come to fruition, really, with this lovely book. She is a writer, a photographer. She writes on art, history, travel, spirituality. She's lived in Rome, Venice, so clearly lives in her soul very deeply. And I'm thrilled. You know, you never know what's going to come out of an esoteric quest. And whereas it's not the only factor, I'm sure it's a significant factor in producing this book. So I'm delighted that Julianne is here to tell us about it. So Julianne Dodo, please welcome.
Sticking around for the end of this wonderful weekend. Thank you so much. And it was in 2000 at the Open Centers Conference in Florence where I really started to learn about the Western esoteric tradition in depth. And there were so many wonderful scholars there. It was so inspiring. After that, of course, I started to read. But the beauty of Italy has always enchanted me. I've gone back again and again, pulled like a magnet. And have lived there, just actually returned a few months ago from living in Venice. First of all, you're going to have to use your imagination because the pictures are more beautiful than this. So hopefully when you see the book, you'll see the true beauty of the photographs. And of course, if you're in Italy, you can go see the actual artwork. So when I began to read some of the works of Renaissance writers and the works of the scholars who I had met, combined with how I felt when I was in Italy, looking at these things, something came together and resulted. All these years later, is this book. I do talk about the background of Renaissance philosophy and the history of it in the book, but not in great detail. It's mostly a collection of quotes from some of the great writers and artists of the Renaissance, combined imaginatively with photographic images that express the classic Renaissance idea of beauty. So it's a book to experience, to evoke a feeling, so that you get hopefully inspired by the combination of the beauty and the wisdom. And in Renaissance Italy, the role of the artist played an important part in society. Artists were said to be able to contact higher forces and bring a divine essence into their creations. And viewers, too, could contact that divine essence by seeing the art. So I want to move a little bit quickly because we don't have too much time. Ralph has already, and other people have already spoken about the ecumenical council that occurred in the mid-15th century in Florence, where a number of scholars came over with the ecumenical council, were trying to resolve the differences between the Eastern and Western branches of the church. Constantinople was under threat of Turkish invasion, and the emperor was hoping that he could, if he could resolve the differences between the Western and the Eastern branches, that he could get help from the West in his struggle against the Turks. So during this conference, a very important man, George Gemistus Plethon, who was the greatest Neoplatonic scholar of his age, spoke to Renaissance humanists in Florence about the difference between Aristotle and Plato. Now, Plato had been studied a bit. You know, there had been some Greek scholars coming over before this time. But this was the big, real opening. And Cosimo de' Medici, the ruler of Florence and an ardent humanist who loved ancient texts, was inspired to create his own Platonic Academy, which he did in 1462. And he appointed Marsilio Ficino as his head. So there were three strands of thought that intermingled during the Renaissance: humanism, Hermeticism, and Neoplatonism. So humanism started officially with Petrarch in the early 14th century with the recovery of ancient Latin texts, such as Cicero and Virgil, which Petrarch felt could be used as guides to earthly life. Whereas in the Middle Ages, people were waiting to die to receive, hopefully, their rewards. Now the emphasis started to be placed on this life here and now. At the same time, there were excavations in Rome, because Rome had fallen into ruins during the Middle Ages. And it represented the glory and honor of ancient times. So in the 15th century, though, due to various political factors, it began to be rebuilt. And so this ancient architecture and art began to be rediscovered. And artists would go to Rome and study the architecture and the sculptures that were being made. At the same time, they started to study Vitruvius again. And Hermeticism and Platonism came later in the mid-15th century. And as we talked about, it was during the Ecumenical Council that all these scholars started coming over. And then later, when Constantinople did fall to the Turks, many more came. So now we have the next picture. Oops. Well, here's Florence, and this was taken from the Piazzale Michelangelo, which is a hill above Florence, where the beautiful church of San Miniato is. How many people have been to Florence? Oh, almost everyone. So I came out of the church and came down to get the bus back to Florence and saw this gorgeous view. Florence was said to be the place of the new golden age during the 15th century. People look back to the Greco-Roman world and wanted to reevoke that and bring back the ancient learning and music and rhetoric and scholarship and poetry. And this is the famous picture of Marsilio Ficino, which is in the Duomo in Florence. He had been in the Medici household from when he was a child. His father was the physician to Cosimo. And when Cosimo met Marsilio for the first time, he said, "Your Marsilio here has been sent down from heaven to heal souls." So he immediately recognized something. They had this rapport. And from an early age, then, Marsilio was groomed. He studied, he was supported by Cosimo. He was a philosopher, a linguist, an astrologer, a doctor, and as Stephen said, doctors were astrologers at that time. And later he was a priest. He was a canon of the Cathedral of Florence. He has been described as a hunchback with a lisp and prone to melancholy. But he was a brilliant and charismatic person. He didn't travel, he stayed mostly in Careggi, the villa that Cosimo installed him. And he engaged in a wide correspondence with people from all walks of life. He was the first to translate the complete works of Plato, as well as many Neoplatonists, commentaries on early Greek Christian texts, the Corpus Hermeticum, which we've talked about, and we'll talk a little bit about, and the Orphic hymns. He also produced a great number of his own writings. What he did was he gave Western readers the ability to study Plato and these Neoplatonists on their own, now that it was translated into Latin. And with the advent of movable type and the printing press, there was a widespread diffusion of Platonic ideas. He wanted to integrate the ideas he had found in Plato, the Neoplatonic writings, and the Corpus Hermeticum, which all expressed a belief in the immortality of the soul and a longing of the soul to return to its divine source with Christianity. Here's the Villa Careggi, which Ralph showed us on the outskirts of Florence, where Ficino worked, lived, and ultimately died. And this was where the Platonic Academy took place. They saw themselves as a continuation of ancient Platonism, and the work that happened here is what became Renaissance Platonism or Neoplatonism, because at that time, probably you know, Neoplatonism wasn't a word, it wasn't coined until the 19th century. So they were Platonists. The more famous of the people who gathered here were Lorenzo the Magnificent, who was Cosimo's grandson, Angelo Poliziano, Giovanni Pico della Mirandola, and of the artists Botticelli and Michelangelo. Philosophers, lawyers, politicians, clergy, physicians, musicians, artists all gathered here. It was kind of an intellectual salon where there were lectures, discussions, and banquets modeled after Plato's Symposium. There were two purposes: to promote the perennial wisdom of ancient theologians, synthesizing Christianity with the ancient theologians, to create a kind of a new religion, a syncretic religion, and to have a direct influence on the arts as an accessible way of bringing it to a contemporary humanity. Now, when most of the pictures that I'm going to show you of the art is not religious art, but in fact, most of the art in the Renaissance was religious. So this is an unfair skewing in a way, okay? But this is a religious and it's a work of art. It's difficult to see. In that time, they used to take a religious painting. This is called The Miracle of the Sacrament, and they would put contemporary people in it. So it's difficult to see, but on the left is Marsilio. In the middle is Pico della Mirandola, and on the right is Angelo Poliziano. Pico was a genius. I don't use that word lightly, but he had a very short life, but a very eventful life. He was a count, a brilliant linguist. He studied at various universities. He was the greatest of the syncretic philosophers. He wrote something called the Oration on the Dignity of Man, which came to be called the Manifesto of the Renaissance. And Poliziano came to Florence as a boy from Montepulciano, who was born, and that's why his name was Poliziano. After his father was killed by enemies of the Medici, he was taken into the Medici household and was a tutor to Lorenzo's children. So these were really the three greats. There were many greats, but these were the three greats. Among the texts that Ficino translated were the Orphic hymns. This is Apollo. This is by Raphael. This is a detail from a painting called Parnassus, which of course is the famous mountain in Central Greece where the Oracle of Delphi, or Delphi, was. And here Apollo is playing an Renaissance instrument called a lira da braccio. And Ficino also played one of these instruments, and he called it his Orphic lyre. Apollo was said to have taught the lyre to Orpheus. And of course, Apollo was god of the sun, of light, of music, and fine arts. And these are the muses, who are goddesses, who inspire the creation of art, music, and poetry. So the mythological figure of Orpheus was sometimes said to be a priest of the Greek god Dionysus. And with his music, Orpheus could bring beings to a state of ecstatic divine consciousness. It was said he could charm all of nature. Ficino set the Orphic hymns to music, or they would sometimes improvise music and engage in this ritual activity of playing the hymns and singing them, I guess, reciting them. And one time when Piccino was playing and singing these hymns, he had a certain request in his mind. And at that moment, when he was playing his instrument, a letter arrived from Cosimo de' Medici granting his wish. He felt that it had an effect. So it was kind of a synchronicity. But for Piccino, Orpheus was a real ancient theologian who had learned the secrets of immortality from Hermes Trismegistus, and passed them on to Pythagoras, Plato, and the other Neoplatonic philosophers, which then Piccino understood to be fully unfolded in the Christian revelation. So the next picture we've seen also before, Hermes Trismegistus. And as Ralph told us, this is in the Siena Cathedral. And you can't see it, but underneath it says contemporary of Moses. So they actually did think he was a contemporary of Moses, who had foreseen Christianity. That was, I don't know, an excuse or a reason that it was kind of okay to study Hermes, because it had to do with Christianity. He had foreseen Christianity. Whereas in fact, later, of course, we found out that the Corpus Hermeticum and the Hermetic text had been composed in Alexandria in the first few centuries of the modern era. So, as we know, this is the thrice great Hermes, the greatest of all priests, all philosophers, and all kings, an ancient sage, perhaps human, perhaps divine, had revealed the truth of existence and the syncretic combination of the Greek god Hermes and the Egyptian god Thoth, both gods of writing and magic. There had been a document, a Hermetic document before the Renaissance, and that was the Emerald Tablet, which inspired Renaissance and medieval alchemists, where the line, as above, so below, comes from. Egyptian, Judaic, and Greek philosophies all speak of the unifying principle of the macrocosm and the microcosm. Another thread in the syncretic philosophy of the Renaissance was the Jewish Kabbalah, which had come with Jews fleeing Spain and Portugal even before their expulsion. You know, they were suffering oppression. And Cosimo offered them a place of refuge in Florence. Florence was a very tolerant place for them. So some scholars were also studying Kabbalah. In particular, Pico della Mirandola, who was said to have a vast Kabbalistic library. And so we know that alchemists were trying to transform one metal into another with the hope of, or with the highest goal, really, of transforming the self and coming to higher states of consciousness. The syncretic approach was what was happening during the Renaissance, seeking the common thread in various spiritual traditions. Hermeticism, Neoplatonism, and Kabbalah, and the writings of Piccino all speak of the human soul as holding a central and important place, which connects the individual with the heavenly spheres, that every natural thing is infused with the divine essence, and that similar traits are said to be repeated through all levels of reality. We're going to move ahead about 100 years now. Just to show you this picture of an alchemical studio, which was done about 1570 in the Palazzo Vecchio, one of the homes of the Medici. The bearded man, if you can make him out, on the lower right, is Francesco I, who's a distant relative of Cosimo and Lorenzo from 100 years earlier. He was an alchemist, and this painting was in his studiolo. The studiolo was a place where wealthy people and princes had these rooms in their homes where they put precious objects, objects that meant something to them personally, that reflected the qualities and aspirations and knowledge of the individual, And the Duke spent hours here pursuing his interests in alchemy and chemistry. The next picture is what I have on the cover, which is The Birth of Venus. Now, the more famous Birth of Venus is the one by Botticelli. This one was done for Francesco's father. His name was Cosimo I. He was also said to be an alchemist. It was done by Giorgio Vasari and assistants. It's called The Allegory on Water, Birth of Venus. It's in the apartment of the elements. And this was a room the entire Palazzo Vecchio, as you recall, is filled with these wonderful paintings with all kinds of symbolism. But this was in the apartment of the elements, and each wall is dedicated to a different element, air, earth, water, and fire. Cosimo I, for whom this painting was done, was actually the person who created the Uffizi. He was also a great patron of the arts, as were all the Medici. It has a lot of symbolism and significance. In fact, Vasari actually wrote a book because it's so intense. I don't know what your feelings are. If you get any impressions, I mean, I like to just look at that and see how I feel. I love it. It has such a magical, lighthearted quality, but it does have a lot of symbolism. I'll just mention a few things. On the one hand, it was kind of an homage to Cosimo I, who calmed the waters of Florence. He made peace between, between Florence and Siena. And so it was a history painting. There are elements in it that reflect his astrological chart and qualities that he was said to have had. Many people would see these things, they would come in, they didn't necessarily know what all these symbols were about. Some did, and many didn't, just like now. So it's a history painting. It also has humanistic, hermetic, and Neoplatonic symbolism. Water element is the source of all life, purification, and regeneration. The birth of Venus, of course, the entire Renaissance was like the birth of Venus, the birth of beauty in the world. Again, the rebirth. There were two Venuses. Aphrodite is Venus in Greek. Aphrodite Urania was born from the sea foam. Does anybody know the story of how she was born? After Saturn castrated Uranus, his father, at the request of his mother Gaia, mother of the earth. Because Uranus had buried children deep within the earth, causing Gaia pain. So, what he castrated, the genitals, fell into the sea, creating this foam, and this Aphrodite was born from that. There was another Aphrodite, who was a child of Zeus and Dione, and she was said to be a more common Aphrodite, a more common kind of love. So there were two kinds of love in the Renaissance, the more spiritual love, which could involve, you know, a sexual aspect or not, and the common love. Of course, Piccino wasn't talking about sexual love, he was talking about platonic love. But others were. So this is the celestial Aphrodite. On the right is Neptune, god of the sea. On the left is Venus, goddess of the sea. And all sea creatures are bringing all kinds of gifts, some of which are corals and pearls, which are alchemical symbols. We'll go ahead. There's just so much to say about this painting. This, unfortunately, we can't see it very well. It's the night sky over Florence. And it was the actual night sky. It was either July 4th or July 9th, 1442. And the interesting thing about this is it's in a church. It's in the old sacristy of San Lorenzo. And there were many astrological paintings in churches at that time. Astrology was widely accepted during the Renaissance, although not completely. Piccino was actually called before Pope Innocent VIII at one point and accused of practicing magic, and he was able to defend himself, and nothing terrible happened. Um, Ficino was an astrologer and believed in astrology. He himself was born under the influence of Saturn, which is said to cause a melancholy personality, but also a tendency for philosophers and artists. So I was also born influenced by Saturn, so I feel that that's my relationship with Ficino. And he recommended various remedies to help with whatever afflicted you in your chart, herbs, gems, and making talismans under the right planetary influences. I did find, there's actually a website, there's a guy who is creating these talismans now and does Renaissance astrology. For Ficino, the planets don't determine events, but they can signify them. And therefore we can use them as a way to see what's happening and be prepared. In the Corpus Hermeticum, the soul takes on the characteristics of certain planets at incarnation, or let's go with them, as it ascends to higher levels of consciousness. Plotinus also said that the ordering of stars is in a horoscope corresponds directly to the human temperament and personality, but that it is possible to transcend this lower nature and move towards the higher, the beautiful, and the godlike. And as we ascend, or possibly descend, because going down and going up can sometimes we go either way to contact these forces, it's possible to receive spiritual guidance, spiritual inspiration. Artists had to contact unseen forces, as I mentioned earlier, to bring forth great works of art. Here we have Moses by Michelangelo. The purpose of art, according to Ficino, was to give concrete visual, literary, or musical form to a divine essence. An attribute of the divine essence is beauty, and an appreciation of earthly beauty leads to an understanding of the beauty of God. This was supposed to be in the Vatican as part of the tomb of Pope Julius II, but it didn't wind up there. And this is in a church in Rome called San Pietro in Vincoli, St. Peter in Chains. There's a wonderful book called The Sistine Secrets, where the authors Benjamin Black and Warren Doliner talk about Michelangelo's great interest in Jewish mysticism, and they illustrate how he embedded a lot of Jewish symbolism in the Sistine Chapel. So, of course, Moses is the greatest of the Jewish prophets, and Michelangelo planned to use this as a centerpiece of the Pope's tomb. What appear to be horns on Michelangelo's head were actually created to reflect light from a hole in the ceiling that was later sealed up by church authorities because Michelangelo wanted his statue's face to reflect the divine light written about in Exodus when Moses came down from Mount Sinai after receiving the Ten Commandments. For Michelangelo, the human body was a reflection of the divine, but also the inner self of the human being. And here we can see Moses' strength in his arms, his energy in his twisted position, and the fierce expression on his face. For Michelangelo, the function of art was to represent an ideal beauty, something higher, better than anything that could be found on earth. And the artist's function was to bring pre-existent forms out of the material at hand. But an artist had to have a special talent, called intelletto, and Michelangelo thought he had that. I don't know what he thought about the other artists around, but he had that, and so he was able to see the concetto, or the idea, or the figure already in the marble and uncovered. He said, "I saw the marble in the angel and carved until I set him free." Next picture is very dark. It is Mars, Venus, and Amor by Tiziano. And there were many, many pictures of Venus and Mars during the Renaissance. It's the union of opposites. Venus is said to temper Mars' warlike tendencies. So it was necessary to have sweetness and sting in order to bring these elemental forces together and create something else, something higher. Sometimes it was said that Venus and Mars had a daughter named Harmony, and other times that they had a son, of course, named Eros, or Cupid. Ficino defined love as a desire to return to the cause, to the source of everything, to recover the more perfect way of being from which all creatures are degenerated in the process of being created. And according to Plato and Plotinus, and through Piccino about the desire, divine as a desire for beauty. Piccino said, he who uses love properly certainly praises the beauty of the body, but through that contemplates the higher beauty of the soul, the mind, and God, and admires and loves that more strongly. And of course, Plato's Ladder of Love speaks about going from the particular body to all bodies, to admiring the beauty of the mind and the soul and the unseen beauty of the world. Next, we have sacred and profane love, also by Tiziano, two kinds of love, in two different ways. Human love and divine love. Human love, we love somebody, maybe we want to have a baby with that person. Divine love, we want to rise to higher levels. Jocelyn Godwin in the Pagan Dream of the Renaissance says that whereas in Christianity the lower desires arose from and led to sin, the liberating essence of Platonism was that all levels were valid, so they weren't making these value judgments. But there were also people who were writing dialogues about human love, about two kinds of human love. One was called vulgar or dishonest, and the other was called honest or virtuous. A courtesan named Toya D'Aragona wrote a book called Dialogue on the Infinity of Love, and she says dishonest love exists among coarse, crude people, whether they're from the upper class or low. It's born of the desire to get pleasure from the thing that is love. As soon as they've got what they wanted, they don't love anymore. Often their love turns to hate. Honest love is characteristic of noble people, whether they're rich or poor. The principal aim of this kind of love is the transformation of oneself into the object of one's love, with the wish that the loved one be transformed as well, so that the two become one. So they had this very idealistic view of love, which I love. I love an idealistic view. here we have two Venuses. Which one is sacred, which is profane? Anybody?
I will say that the profane one is the one with the dress, and the sacred is the temple one.
Good. Why?
Because of the celebration of the human body and the celebration of love.
Yeah, okay, good. Yeah, she's taller, she's sitting, she's overtowering this other one. This is a tomb, it's a casket that's been made into a fountain, that's Cupid playing. And in the background, behind the nude woman, is a church, and she's holding an oil candle representing eternity. However, this Venus on the left is also dressed plainly. She doesn't have a lot of jewelry and things. So they could both be a noble kind of love, one divine and one earthly. So I'm focusing here on beauty and love. Okay, there are a lot of themes in Renaissance art, but this is what I'm doing today. This is Cupid and it's Cupid and Psyche, and it's in the Palazzo Te in Mantua. This is in a villa commissioned by Federico II Gonzaga as a retreat where he could spend time with his mistress, but it was also used to receive important gifts. And in this legend, Cupid falls in love with Psyche, the most beautiful woman in the world. Against the wishes of his mother, Venus, who was very jealous. Cupid has Zephyr, god of the winds, bring Psyche to his palace. And he only comes to her at night, and he won't let her look at him, which is a common theme. If you look at a god, you will die. But one night she does, and a drop of oil falls on him, and he awakens. She's banished. She has to wander the earth, performing all kinds of difficult tasks. And eventually, he comes back, and they get married. They have a child, which you can't see here, but it's in the middle between them, called Voluptas, which means pleasure. Psyche is soul, Cupid is divine love. Before she's ready to see him, she tries to see him and is punished, but after she is purified, she attains immortality and eternal union with him. So desire in its highest form, which is desire to be good, the one God in Neoplatonism, the ineffable, results in great happiness. Voluptas was used to designate primitive and also exalted forms of love. Plotinus repeatedly advised his disciples to model their expectations of mystical bliss on human passion. That was the closest we could come to it.
Who's the artist?
This is Giulio Romano.
Okay. Thank you.
We're not going to have a lot of time to talk about this, so let's mention a couple of things before that. You could write books. And there's a wonderful article on the Lapis website, which Ralph told me about, by David Weidler, called Eros and the Divine Circle of Love. There's also a wonderful book by Edgar Wynn called Pagan Mysteries of the Renaissance. So this shows the two loves. On the left, Zephyr, Lord of the Winds, is accosting Chloris, a nymph. He feels bad about that, and so he turns her into Flora, goddess of the eternal spring, and goddess of flowers. Venus is in the middle as a moderating factor. Cupid is above, shooting his love arrow, pointing it towards one of the three graces. The three graces were beauty, passion, and chastity. Passion or pleasure and chastity. And so the one in the middle is chastity. She's turned towards Mercury, who is clearing the clouds with his caduceus, pointing to a higher reality. David Feidler, and also in Pagan and Mysteries of the Renaissance, talk about the three graces, which in simple terms have to do with the three processes of emanation, or the process of emanation from Neoplatonism, from Plotinus. But basically, coming into the world, descending from the one, doing our work in the world, completing God's creation, and returning back. And this painting is also kind of the talisman, bringing in beneficial influences. So we look at the painting, and who said the unconscious love symbols, Ellen, I think. So that is what this is about. We somehow make the connections. So we each come into the world and have something to do here. And we think everybody is important. Each person plays a part. So with the purpose of life being to make the world more beautiful, I think Renaissance artists and architects fulfilled that for me. And this is the Giusti Gardens in Verona, outside of Verona. In Renaissance Neoplatonism, during the Renaissance, gardens were an important art, equal to architecture. Rich people always had gardens connected to their houses. Nature was already perfect, but could be brought even to a higher perfection through an artist. Renaissance artists and architects, as I said, were looking back to a golden age, and part of that golden age was Arcadia, a mythic garden of great perfection where animals and humans and magical creatures all existed in a state of peace and harmony. And they just loved having gardens as what was called a locus of menace, a pleasant place where you could escape life's pain and struggle and rest in contemplation of beauty and harmony. And, you know, nowadays Italy is filled with traffic and all kinds of stuff, but there are these pockets, and I highly recommend the Giusti Gardens if you're ever in Verona, because it's absolutely gorgeous. Here we have another garden, or an aspect of a garden. This is from the Boboli Gardens, connected to the Pitti Palace, which are in Florence, which were also owned by the Medici. So here we have this mythic creature, Perseus, riding his winged horse Pegasus. Perseus was the son of Jupiter, lord of the gods. A famous Greek hero killed Medusa and saved Andromeda. So Renaissance gardens had certain aspects in common. Bill had evergreens, flowing water, fountains, and statues. And of course, I had to include Diana of Ephesus with her many breasts. She signifies the great mother here offering nurturance and sustenance to all of life. And this is in the Villa d'Este at Tivoli outside of Rome. And it's a wonderful villa and garden filled with all kinds of fountains. There was a fountain there called the Fountain of the Organ, which used to actually play music. But this is Diana. Her sacred temple Her sacred temple was in a place that is now present-day Turkey, and one of the seven wonders of the world. So I'm now finishing up with architecture. Steve has already told us so much about this. I wanted to mention something about the night sky of Florence, that actually Toscanelli apparently was the one who advised on that and told the artist, which may have been Alberti or may have been someone else, how to design that. So, as Steve has told us, Renaissance Neoplatonists believe that the fundamental truths of the universe were based on mathematical principles, and that everything was created according to common principles. And then Pythagoras, of course, talked about the harmony of the spheres, a mathematical concept which postulated the harmonious relationships of the distance between the planets and their rotations. And their movements were said to create a kind of music that was inaudible to all but the most highly evolved beings. These harmonic frequencies were also said to be reflected in the microcosm, a kind of internal music of the human body. So we have music going on in here, but we can't hear it. Okay, so here's Vitruvian Man, Leonardo da Vinci, who was a great genius of the Renaissance, of course, based on the correlation of the ideal human proportions with geometry, circle, spiritual, square, and material. Renaissance architects employed the divine ratio used, taught by Pythagoras and used by Vitruvius. So architects such as Brunelleschi, Alberti, Palladio, Michelangelo, Bramante, all conceived of mathematical plans using the same geometry, so that entering a building designed according to these harmonious proportions would evoke a sense of connection to a higher reality. And I'm just going to show a few pictures now. This is San Giorgio Maggiore in Venice by Palladio. And of course, Palladio has influenced so much of architecture. Architecture wouldn't be the same now if it hadn't been for Palladio. And this is by Bramante. It's the Tempietto di San Pietro, the St. Peter's Temple. It's a kind of a mini shrine in Rome. And it rises above an underground room that is said to contain the hole left by the cross on which Peter was crucified, inspired by ancient classical temple design. And the last picture is Santo Spirito this is also difficult to see, in Florence. So that's it. I went quickly, and I think I just about made it. Ficino wrote of the soul is immortal and divine. Because of this, he said, humans have the ability to be in contact directly with the divine, and art can show us its resemblance of the higher world. And I just want to read this one quote quickly, just to leave you with this. Oh, friends, live freely and uninhibitedly, without confining yourselves. Live with joy, for heaven's joy created you, and its motion and expansion. When you live with joy, heaven will preserve you. Live joyfully day by day in the present moment, for worry about the present steals it from you, and steals the future too. Worry about the future turns it into the past. Therefore, I implore you, live joyfully.